time as I do record my shiurim, and I apologize to those of you listening who are just picking up now, but I started the recording late. So I record my shiurim every single day, whether it's my 5-minute Mishnayos shiur, or I record my Sefer HaChinuch shiur, or any shiur that I give during the week, I try to record. So one time I press record on my iPhone, and I don't know how it works exactly, but my phone is able to pick up the location where I'm at. So right now, for example, if you look at my phone, it says Young Israel America. It knows that I'm in the Young Israel America. But one time I pressed record, and it said Cure of Ours. And I said, so I said, this is an uncomfortable situation. So that's the question that I'm asking you. How do we know that we are celebrating the right religion right now, and we don't really belong across the street at Cure of Ours? Okay, what do you mean by that? So in other words, we know that some stuff should happen after the Messiah comes, the redemption should come, okay? And that didn't happen. Okay, so that's a good thing for us to say now in the year 2019. That's for, hindsight is always 2020. But how about when Jesus was alive? How would we have known? Right, all the rabbis hated Jesus. Why did they hate him so much? Okay, what did they disagree with?
The kasher in the first place.
The what?
Didn't he disagree with the kasher? He said, what you put in your mouth.
Yeah, it's...
And speaking, he disagreed with what the rabbis were saying. He moved the law to the left.
Okay, so he was like a left-wing rabbi.
Yeah, that's exactly what he was.
But he was
supposedly
against the corruption of the rabbis at the time. I don't know.
So what? So Rabbi Akiva, there are Gemaras that say how Rabbi Akiva wanted to bite rabbis like a donkey. He hated rabbis so much. So what's wrong with hating rabbis? Everyone hates rabbis. What else? Why don't we follow Jesus? Okay, so it's not a question that we can answer al regalachas. It's not a question that we can answer in 20 seconds. But there was a nice write-up that I found online. So let's take a look at source number one. It's an article that I found on Aish.com, and Aish usually loves discussing these kinds of things. So let's see what they say. One of the most common questions we receive at Aish.com is, why don't Jews believe in Jesus? Let's understand why, not to disparage other religions, but rather to clarify the Jewish position. Jews do not accept Jesus as the Messiah because, A, Jesus did not fulfill the Messianic prophecy, so again, that's something we only really know in hindsight. B, Jesus did not embody the personal qualifications of the Messiah. So one of the most important things we have to understand is that the Mashiach can't be some schlub that comes off the streets. It could be that he was a schlub and then he became a Baal Tshuva and then he was this great guy, but you can't come as a schlub and be this guy who does not fulfill and does not upkeep all the commandments of the Torah and say, by the way, Mashiach, we'll get to that a little bit when it comes to Shabtai Tzvi, who many of you seem to be familiar with. And Shabtai Tzvi was someone who, what was the most telltale sign that we know Shabtai Tzvi wasn't Mashiach? Because he converted to Islam at the end of his life, or at some point, not at the end of his life. So that was a pretty telltale sign that we know he's not Jewish, and that he's probably not going to be the Mashiach. C, biblical verses referring to Jesus are mistranslations. Okay, so even if there are verses that you can find in theory that are, there are people like to say there are verses that say like Yeshu or Yeshua, so people maybe point to that, so that's just totally wrong. And then finally, Jewish belief is based on national revelation. So in other words, this takes issue with the fact that Jesus was all about like the closed door things where God only spoke to him behind the curtain and never in front of everyone. That's another reason why we don't like Muhammad as well. That's why we don't like Islam, because he went up on a donkey or something and he flew up and that's where God spoke to him. We don't like that. Judaism only believes in revelation when it comes to the masses. So in particular, when it comes to Matan Torah, when we receive the Torah, how did it work? Right? So anyone, how did it work? How did we receive the Torah? Ah, okay, good. So tell me.
The first two directly.
Okay, so at first God tried to give the entire Torah to the Jewish people, or at least the Ten Commandments to the Jewish people. The Jewish people didn't like that. The Medrash says that they couldn't take it, that they died and they came back to life because they were so in shock by hearing God's voice. But the point is that there was an attempt at mass revelation, and everyone is also surrounding the mountain when Moshe did go up to receive the rest. So again, everyone was there at the beginning, and then towards the end, God had to sort of fill in the rest with Moshe, just the two of them, for 40 days. But we believe that there has to be some sort of mass revelation. The other religions, both Jesus and Muhammad, that did not happen. that's how we know for sure that Jesus was not the Messiah. So there is a lot more to talk about when it comes to Jesus, but I just wanted to put that out there. You can't have a conversation about false messiahs and not mention Jesus. Number two, who is the second most famous false messiah? You all said it already? Good, Shabtai Tzvi. Who was Shabtai Tzvi? Oh, I'll tell you this. I have a lot of copy and pasted excerpts from an article on him. So the more you tell me about him, the less we have to read inside. So what do we know about Shabtai Tzvi? Anything? Shabtai Tzvi was?
No.
Much later, though.
Yeah, when?
Much later.
When?
1626.
Okay, good. Yeah. Listen, when we're talking about thousands of years, who cares? Yeah. Okay, good. So he was right in the later, much later in the 1600s. Okay. What else do we know about him? I appreciate that you guys are all reading ahead so that I don't have to read as a group. Okay, fine. So everyone here knows who Shabtai Tzvi is, maybe, but we don't know who exactly who he was or what he did. So let's take a look inside. We'll read through it slowly. Maybe we won't read through all of it. I know we're all tired and hungry. But let's see what this essay has to say. So it's an essay called Mavericks, Mystics, and False Messiahs, Episodes from the Margins of Jewish History. It's written by a colleague of mine, or by Pinny Dunner, who has a lot of fascinating works out there. So he writes as follows. He writes in the first paragraph in source number 2, "To truly fathom the incomprehensible Shabtai Tzvi episode, first one must have an understanding of its origins in Kabbalah and Jewish mystical tradition. The study of Kabbalah had historically not focused on Messianism or on the process of Jewish redemption from the Gullus, the exile from Jerusalem, that began after the Second Temple was destroyed in 70 CE, which was followed by the widespread dispersion of Jews across the known world. For hundreds of years, the study of Kabbalah was mainly concerned with the mystical and symbolic view of the universe and its creation and understanding God and how to connect with God through the performance of commandments found in the Hebrew scriptures and the Oral Torah." So in other words, we know that if we're going to talk about mysticism at all, if we're going to talk about the coming of the Messiah and these types of things, that it has to be that Kabbalah does discuss these topics. However, what this article says over here is that originally when Kabbalah and mysticism became prominent in the Jewish world, there was no talk of the redemption. It wasn't really spoken about so much. People who learned Kabbalah wanted to know about how the world was created and all these different things. But in terms of the redemption, that only came later on. Take a look at paragraph number 2 over here in source number 2. I have these little boxes that mark it. "After the dramatic expulsion of Jews from Spain in 1492, this paradigm shifted. The upheaval caused by Spanish expulsion and by the Inquisition that followed in its wake shook the Jewish world to its foundations, probably more than any other event since the destruction of the Jerusalem Temple 1400 years earlier. During the 16th century, Tzfas, a small community in the northeast of Eretz Yisrael, then under Ottoman rule, emerged as the headquarters of Kabbalah in the Jewish world. Its emergence proved to be pivotal, particularly as the Kabbalah espoused by Tzfat Kabbalists was mainly eschatological in theme and content. Eschatology is the branch of theology concerned with the end of days." So in other words, it was only until after the Spanish Inquisition that Jews started to get really into what's going to happen at the end of days. Why would you be so concerned about what's going to happen at the end of days following the Inquisition? Yeah, life is horrible right now. All the Jews were kicked out of Spain. We want to know that we have somewhere to go. So we're going to start trying to think about what's going to happen at the end of days. "Some of Judaism's greatest minds and most spiritual of souls found their home in 16th century Tzfas, and to this day, the principal mystical and legal texts of Judaism can be traced to the Tzfas Kabbalists." Right? Everyone who's ever been to Tzfas knows that that's like where all the like heebie-jeebie stuff happens. "The greatest of these Kabbalists and the one with the broadest influence was Rabbi Yitzchak Luria Ashkenazi, otherwise known as the Arizal." Take a look at paragraph number 3. "The Arizal's Kabbalistic system, today referred to as Lurianic Kabbalah, revolved almost exclusively around this previously overlooked topic of exile and redemption. In the most basic of terms, it posited that the whole of creation was directly tied into the exile and eventual redemption of the Jewish nation. In summary, God can only allow for the existence of a physical world through an act of withdrawal. The calibration of withdrawal and God within creation is the balance between spiritual and unspiritual or physical in the universe." These are very deep topics. I know we're all hungry and tired, but just try to bear with me for a minute. "The sin of Adam and Eve created a state of imbalance in need of tikkun or correction. The exile of the Jewish people in the physical world is a reflection of this imbalance. If the Jewish nation achieves ultimate perfection as reflected through messianic redemption, then all of creation can at least be in balance and God will have realized his original purpose for creation." So in other words, what this new Arizal Kabbalah did for us was that it gave us a new understanding of how the world will reach the time of the end of days, how we will reach a time of Mashiach coming, and in particular basically just says that if we do enough good things in the world, we fix enough things, the world will come, then the Mashiach will come. That's this new form of Kabbalah that surfaced around this time period. Okay, so this was, again, right after the Inquisition in Spain, 1400s time. Again, when did the Shabtai Tzvi live? 1600s. Very good. Okay, right after that. Okay, paragraph number 4. Lurianic Kabbalah's focus on the redemption had the effect of generating a new enthusiasm for the Messianic era and heightened expectation for its imminence in the Jewish world in a way that had not been seen since Bar Kokhba's tantalizing rise and devastating defeat by the Romans at Beitar 135 CE. Right. So just since the essay over here mentions it, we'll just speak about it for one moment. Right. So we know that there was another famous quote-unquote Mashiach figure that we saw in Jewish history, and that was who?
Bar
Kokhba.
Yes,
right? And
that was actually...
okay, fine. Okay, so Marilyn was ahead of all of us, and as she usually is. So Bar Kokhba was... who loved Bar Kokhba? Good. Rabbi Akiva was a big proponent of Bar Kokhba. He said this must be Mashiach that is coming around. And again, why is it so important that Rabbi Akiva thought Bar Kokhba was going to be the Mashiach? Right, good. It came from Rabbi Akiva's hope, and the historical context makes a lot of sense, right? The temple was destroyed in 70. The rebellion was in around 135. Remember, the second temple took 70 years to be built from the destruction of the first, so it made a lot of sense that Rabbi Akiva thought that this was going to be the Mashiach. The reason why Bar Kokhba doesn't necessarily get put in the same list as a false Messiah is because he had, like, real people backing him, right? Like, Shabtai Tzvi and Jesus had, like, not as important people. Rabbi Akiva, like, the biggest rabbi of the time who backs him, so that's going to not be considered as false Messiah. It's more... other rabbis, it's interesting, if you look throughout the various rabbinic texts, other rabbis did seem to not really agree with Rabbi Akiva. But since Rabbi Akiva was, it's like one of the greatest rabbis in America, or one of the, it's like if Rabbi Avadji Yosef, right, the biggest Sephardic rabbi in the world who just passed away a few years ago, if he would have gotten up and said, so-and-so is Mashiach, like, everyone would listen to that, you know? Even if it wasn't true, everyone would listen to it. So that seems to be the same context over here, yeah?
But wasn't there, like, in my lifetime, a lot of people, I don't know what the Mashiach is supposed to be, but I knew a lot of people really backed Rabbi Schneerson and his movement in the world.
Yeah.
Because I can remember when you could not walk in the street with a kippah,
yeah,
and he gave a feeling to my children and my grandchildren about how important it is to be a Jew, and he gave us a wonderful...
Yeah.
He left a legacy.
So
I don't know what the Mashiach is supposed to do. I know people are redeeming and coming out, but he did leave a mark. And I suspect maybe in these historical times, that's what these people did.
It's a really good point that you bring up, and talking about the Rebbe is probably a separate year in its own right, and maybe one that we would not record.
Right.
Just to briefly address it for a moment, the main qualification of Mashiach is that he doesn't die. And that's why we don't believe that the Rebbe is Mashiach. As to the people out there who do believe the Rebbe is Mashiach, it's sort of heresy to believe it.
About Eliyahu, you know, they didn't die. They live on, but they're not here physically, but we invite them into the house. So.
Right. So there are a group of people that... that are listed as, I think, a count of 9 people in total,
right,
that are said that never died. They went up to the heavens.
Right.
The last person that happened to was like 1800 years ago.
Right.
So for it to happen again would be like a little bit, you know.
I mean, I don't know.
No, don't get me wrong.
No,
if it happened to be that the Lubavitch Rebbe walked into the room right now and said, "I'm a Sheikh," I'd say, okay, I guess I was wrong. But our belief generally seems to be that it's not the case.
I understand that.
Someone else had a question? No? Okay, good. So... that's the historical context, right? Everyone wants the Mashiach to come, and there's this new Kabbalistic system that allows for a Mashiach to be here. So, now, part B. Who was Shabtai Tzvi? So, the thing you have to know about Shabtai Tzvi was that he didn't start off as this amazing, great guy. Let's take a look outside. So, let us turn now to the protagonist of our story, the Messianic pretender, Shabtai Tzvi. His biography is unsurprisingly full of contradictions, glorified by accolades and vilified by detractors. The truth about him is hard to pin down, but some of the facts are incontrovertible. He was born on August 1st, 1626, which that year was also the 9th of Av, Tisha B'Av. So one of the most important things to realize about him is that if we believe that Tisha B'Av is going to be the day that we ultimately ultimately will celebrate as the day of the redemption of the Jewish people with the rebuilding of the Beis HaMikdash. So it would be very nice if the Mashiach was born on Tisha B'Av. So that's why people do like to say that he was born on Tisha B'Av. My understanding is that even this is not necessarily 100% fact. There are people who argue and say that he was not born on Tisha B'Av. Again, wanting to take away even that little fact from him, from his life. But so fine. So some say he was born on Tisha B'Av when Jews fast and spend the day mourning the destruction of the two Jerusalem temples. But there was no fast or mourning on the day Shabbat he was born. Why? As it was Saturday, just like this year. And fasting is prohibited on the Jewish Sabbath. So, ooh, that's very fancy. Now, this guy was born on Tisha B'Av, but it was Shabbos, so we were all celebrating. Maybe it's like foreshadowing for when he's older, when he'll be like Mashiach. So you're already starting to see some of the propaganda that could have come out of this. Mystical literature is insistent that the Messiah will be born on Tisha B'Av to signal the final redemption will emerge out of the ashes of destruction. In any event, it was in honor of the day of his birth, in Hebrew, Shabbat, that the parents of the newborn boy named their son Shabtai. Good, right? Shabtai, Shabbat. Okay. Shabtai, so he was born in the town of Izmir in Turkey, known in those days as Smyrna. His family was originally from Greece, but his father Mordechai had moved the family to the coastal city to more easily and profitably conduct his international trading business. It is possible that the family was of Ashkenazic origin, blah, blah, blah. Okay, you can read more if you want on your own. Look at the right side where no one knows. No one knows exactly when Shabtai Tzvi first started studying Kabbalah, but it was certainly at a young age. Evidently, he studied it on his own, which was highly unusual. Aspiring Kabbalists are expected to master their subject with guidance from a mentor, hence the term Kabbalah or received teachings, right? So one of the important things, again, to know about Shabtai Tzvi in his early life was the fact that he decided to study Kabbalah. It's one of the reasons why there's this idea, right? Who here, if someone wants to learn the Zohar, what age should they start?
40.
Everyone knows it's 40. Where in the world does that come from?
Rabbi Akiva?
The Zohar wasn't around when Rabbi Akiva was alive, so probably not. Okay, could be, right? So it's, see, okay, good. So fine. So let's say it is linked to that. Well, why did we change it all of a sudden? The second the Zohar was written, was that the rule? Could you not study Kabbalah before 40, before that?
I think that was the time of your life when you were mature enough to be able to understand what was written.
Okay. So it seems to be that historically the reason why everyone knows this, you only learn Zohar when you're 40, is because of this time period. Because of Shabtai Tzvi. He's the one that messed it up for all of us. Maybe I might be the only one in the room who does not fit into the category. I'll say no more. So because of Shabtai Tzvi, it seems to be that one is not allowed to learn Zohar before the age of 40 because he was someone who learned it at a very young age. Again, he had no rabbis teaching it to him. And as a result of that, that's one of the reasons why we think he sort of like went off the derech for a little bit because he went cuckoo, right? So we'll see a few more details about his life, but then I really want to get into the more meat and potatoes of his life. So do you see the paragraph, that the next one, this is at 20? Yeah, everyone with me? At 20, where is it? Yeah? I have different sources than you, so... top of page 3. Very good. Okay, at 20, Shabtai Tzvi married for the first time, but the marriage was never consummated, and shortly after the wedding, following a complaint to local rabbis by his new wife's father, the young couple divorced. Almost immediately, Shabtai Tzvi married again, but once again, the marriage was not consummated and ended in divorce. At around the same time, people began to notice that Shabtai Tzvi's behavior was erratic and unpredictable. Sometimes, he was enthusiastically joyful, exuberant, and ecstatic, while at other times, he was depressed, anxious, paranoid, and passive. Anyone? Okay, bipolar, maybe manic depressive. Well, so today we recognize this wild mood swings as symptoms of acute manic depression or bipolar syndrome, but in the 17th century, such symptoms were interpreted somewhat differently. To Shabtai Tzvi's detractors, his behavior was evidence that he was an evil madman. He was a cuckoo. To his support, those words are not there. I added those for effect. To his supporters and devotees, however, his strange behavior attested to the fact that he was a divine and holy man. Right? You read about some of the texts that talk about how the prophets received prophecy in the times of prophecy, and it was like kind of crazy. They would like sit there, they would have convulsions, and they would shake, and they would like scream out words, and like it would look like kind of crazy. Maybe that would take a wild madman to really be like that. So that's why you can see the positive of this. Shabtai Tzvi told people that he regularly experienced visions and he would often stay awake for days at a time without food, right? That's what we call crazy. Occasionally, he would disappear for weeks at a time and no one knew where he had gone. Despite these strange disappearances, his supporters refused to acknowledge that there was anything wrong with him and instead claimed that he needed time on his own to atone for the world's sins. Okay, very nice. Go to the right side. Notwithstanding the support for Shabtai Tzvi in Izmir, his odd behavior eventually began to seriously concern the senior Jewish leadership in the town. And after an emergency meeting meeting, they decided to expel him from the community before his malign influence began to seriously disrupt the equilibrium of the insular and conservative-minded Jewish population. The year was 1651, so make sure to take note of the year. So this is pretty early in his life, 1651. He was 25, and he was kicked out of the town. So that's the first time he got kicked out of someplace. Next paragraph below that. In any event, following his expulsions from Izmir, Shabtai Tzvi proceeded to Salonika in Greece, where he was received respectfully, and he soon befriended all the local rabbis, right? So if you want to get into the town, if you want people to respect you and to like you, you become friends with all the rabbis. Carol knows. But the honeymoon in Salonika was very short-lived. Within weeks, his behavior had deteriorated, and he had begun to act strangely. On one fateful day, Shabtai Tzvi invited all the local rabbis to his home. They arrived to discover that he had set up a wedding canopy in his yard. As they looked on, he proceeded to perform a marriage ceremony between himself and a Torah scroll, as if he was marrying a woman. Shocked by this bizarre behavior, go to the right side of behavior, they immediately arranged to have him evicted from Salonika, and he was gone within a matter of days. So that was the second place that he was expelled from, because again, everyone thought that he was cuckoo for Cocoa Puffs. Going down a little bit more to the paragraph beneath that. No, after a few months.
Yeah.
See with me?
Yeah. Oh, okay.
Sorry, I apologize. Okay, you good? Everyone's good? Okay. After a few months in Egypt, Shabtai Tzvi traveled to Jerusalem, where he seems to have impressed the small community. He spent a year in Jerusalem, and the community's leaders then sent him back to Egypt as their official representative to raise funds. It was there on March 31st, 1664. Take note of the date again. That's 13 years later, that Shabtai Tzvi got married for the third time. Sarah, his bride, was a girl with her own remarkable life story, orphaned during the infamous Chmielnicki massacres of 1648 to 49 in Poland and Ukraine. She was brought up by Gentiles as a Christian. She only discovered her Jewish origins on reaching adulthood, and thereafter began drifting from community to community, possibly in search of her family. A rootless woman, very beautiful, and by all accounts very seductive. Although Sarah had a reputation for immoral behavior, right? So some say that she was actually a prostitute. She would often make the strange claim that she was destined to marry the Messiah, right? So you have two cuckoo people now. A prediction that was the object of great amusement to everyone who knew her. Somehow she came across Shabtai Tzvi in Egypt and she decided to marry him. The wedding took place at the home of Raphael Joseph. Okay, so you have these two crazy people now: one who's going to marry the Mashiach, one who's going to think that he's Mashiach in a few days. And so they're the two peas in a pot. Okay, now go to the right. It was at this point that Shabtai Tzvi stumbled across someone who's involvement in his messianic pretensions was to prove absolutely crucial. Abraham Natan ben Elisha Chaim Ashkenazi, later known to Sabidians as Nathan Hanavi, or Nathan the Prophet, and to everyone else as Nathan of Gaza. So this guy, Nathan of Gaza, is going to be the most important person that Shabtai Tzvi will ever meet. Without Nathan of Gaza was like the best PR guy in the world. Without him, he would never have become the famed Shabtai Tzvi. No one would have cared to know of him. No one would have cared to think about him. Nathan of Gaza, he was just a good marketer. So Nathan would end up as the catalyst that allowed a messianic movement to flourish around the flawed character of Shabtai Tzvi. Before he entered the picture, Shabtai Tzvi had not succeeded at anything except for attracting attention to himself in an assortment of Jewish communities, usually for the wrong reasons. Without Nathan, Shabtai Tzvi would probably have disappeared without a trace, confined to the trash can of forgotten historical eccentrics who have proliferated throughout Jewish history. But that was not to be. A fateful meeting between the two of them would launch a toxic partnership that wreaked havoc across the Jewish world. In 1665, again, take note of that day, that's a year later, Raphael Joseph heard about this young man in Gaza who was claiming to have spectacular visions. By this time, Nathan was being visited by countless pilgrims, and he had acquired a reputation as a healer. All right, so another cuckoo. Intrigued by what he was hearing, Joseph told Shabtai Tzvi about Nathan. Shabtai Tzvi immediately resolved to visit this healer to seek help for his tormented soul. Right, that's another proof to show that he was a little bit of a... He was having some sort of mental issues because he was seeking help for it. His tormented soul is 1600 code word for what we would call nowadays mental disabilities. Within a few days, Shabtai Tzvi set off on a journey from Egypt to Gaza, and as soon as he arrived, he arranged to meet Nathan. Okay, a little bit more. The moment Shabtai Tzvi entered his room, Nathan fell to the ground in a trance, right? So he's really, really crazy now. When he awoke, he informed Shabtai Tzvi that he possessed a precious and unique soul and was none other than the Messiah, right? So the worst thing you can do for like a crazy... The worst thing you could do for someone who's in the high point of a bipolar turn or of a manic depressive state that's at their highest point is to tell them that they are actually as amazing as they think they are, right? That's really going to not do well for their... Uh, for their psyche. Shocked by this startling revelation, Shabtai's feet burst into laughter, right? Who knew? And dismissed Nathan's pronouncement as nonsense. So at first, so you talk about who deserves the blame for this terrible thing that happened, that there was this false Messiah. Was it Nathan the prophet, or was it Shabtai's feet? At this point, it seems like it was whose fault? Nathan, he was the guy who was really doing all these things. He was the one who convinced him. When the meeting was over, Shabtai Tzvi began organizing to leave Gaza, but Nathan simply refused to give up. For 3 weeks, he relentlessly cajoled Shabtai Tzvi to accept what he was telling him and to concede that he was the king Messiah destined to lead the Jews out of exile back to the promised land. Okay, you can keep reading on your own if you want. Let's look at that last paragraph. With the pressure now mounting, it took just one more week for Shabtai Tzvi himself to concede. And 17 Sivan, coinciding with May 31st, 1665, for the first time, Shabtai Tzvi publicly declared himself as the Messiah, King of the Jews and Redeemer of Israel. His first act as Messiah was to abolish the fast of Shiva Asar Beit Hamas. Why would that be his first act?
It's probably the first one that's coming up.
What do you mean? Okay. Okay, let's think a little bit less pessimistically for just a second. Right. He is the Messiah, so he is going to bring the redemption. So maybe Tisha B'Av is a little bit too much to handle right now. He's not going to abolish Tisha B'Av. We'll see the year after. It seems like he does abolish Tisha B'Av. But this year, he just takes out the first of the opening of the 3 weeks, and that is Shiva Asar Beit Tammuz, the 17th of Tammuz. Okay, part C. Finally, the end of Shabtai Tzvi. Okay, so let me fill some stuff in before we read this part. So what happens is Shabtai Tzvi goes around, he's traveling the world, and he's convincing people that he is the Messiah. He gets a number of followers. It's a significant group of people that follow him. I forgot what the actual number is. I think it's something like a third of the Jewish people ended up following him, believing that he was the Messiah. That's a lot of Jews. There were huge detractors of him. But again, he did get this large movement behind him. He was eventually imprisoned by one of the kings, he was told to convert to Islam. He said, okay, that sounds great, can I get out of prison? The guy's like, yeah, you can. So he gets out of prison. He is an Islamic person, and it's at that point where people realize that he's not the Mashiach anymore, because if he's going to convert to another religion, that probably is not our guy. So part C, the end of Shabtai Tzvi. The apostate royal physician then told him in no uncertain terms that there was... Oh, okay, that's right. It says it right here. There's only one solution to the crisis. Shabtai Tzvi's immediate conversion to Islam. If he refused, the Sultan would have no choice but to have him executed on the spot on the grounds that he was a dangerous revolutionary. So he did that. Go to the right side in 1680. Nathan suddenly died at the age of 37 in Macedonia. Despite the death of the movement's main life force, belief in Shabtai Tzvi and the mystical teachings he had espoused persisted for well over a century. And it wasn't until the end of the 1700s, and only after numerous notorious and bitter battles, that the remnants of Shabtai Tzvi's messianic movement finally disappeared from mainstream Jewish life, bringing to an end one of the strangest episodes of modern Jewish history. Now, it's important to understand the history of Shabtai Tzvi, because you have to understand that this still affects us to this very day. There is this fear. As much as we are so wanting of the redemption, Mashiach, and the rebuilding of the Beis HaMikdash, the ingathering of exiles, all these things, because of Shabtai Tzvi, for hundreds of years after, there was a concern that anyone who would even have a whiff of being like messianic in any way, shape, or form, they would totally excommunicate him, because there was a fear that he would become this. And that still has trickled down even to the year 2019. We're horrified of people getting up and saying that they're Mashiach. How do I know that? Give me a proof that we're horrified in 2019 of people saying they're Mashiach.
Oh, that's what happened with
Schneerson. Yeah. Even though we don't believe he is Mashiach, even though, because again, he's not alive anymore, nonetheless, the absolute fear that people have of the movement of people saying that he is the Mashiach, it rings so clear about how we are so afraid of a false Messiah. And so that still seems to be continued from the whole Shabtai Tzvi mess back a little less than 400 years ago. Okay, so with that in mind, so we said there were false Messiahs, there was Jesus, there was Shabtai Tzvi, those are the two famous ones. How will we actually know who Mashiach is? So, well, let me ask you this question first before we even get to that point. How do we know that there is going to be a Mashiach? Bring me a proof. Where does it say in the Torah there's going to be a Mashiach? Nowhere, right? No, it's not written in there. I know you guys have all been like skimming the Torah in your minds. Yeah, so it's not really there. The earliest source seems to be in the Torah, though, and it's more of an allusion than an actual saying it straight out. So let's take a look. It's actually in the prophecy of Bilam. Bilaam is saying all these nice things about the Jewish people that God is putting in his mouth. In source number 3, he says as follows, "What I see for them is not yet. What I behold will not be soon. A star rises from Jacob. A scepter comes forth from Israel. It smashes the brow of Moab, the foundation of all children of Seth." So this sounds like, who is this going to be? Some savior for the Jewish people. A star from Jacob. Why is that language so fascinating? The Hebrew word is kochav. Okay.
But why,
historically, just based on some of the things that we just said, would kochav be such a fascinating term to use to refer to the Mashiach as? Bar kochva. Right? So some people like to say, that's one of the signs that how we knew that it was clear that he was going to be the Mashiach, because his name was literally written in the Torah as being the Messiah. Let's take a look at source number 4. It's the Rabbeinu Bachya, who interprets it just like this, a Midrashic approach. The words, "I will see but not know, refer to David, whereas the subsequent words, "I can see it but not in the near future," refer to the Messiah. The words, "a star comes forth from Yaakov," refer to David, whereas the words, "Vikam shevet Israel," "a scepter bearer emerges from Israel," is a reference to King Messiah. So this pasuk seems to show us that Mashiach will come and be the Savior for the Jewish people. When is Mashiach going to come? Why not?
When the lion lights
out. Okay, well, let's take a look at source number 5 first. So it's the Ani Mamin. Some of us may say it, some of us may not say it, but it's the Ani Mamin that can be found in the back of our Siddur. Ani Ma'amin be'emuna shlema, I believe wholeheartedly. B'vias HaMashiach, in the coming of the Messiah. And the words that we use are so fascinating in this. V'af al pi shiyisma me'a, even though it's going to take a long time, I'm going to wait for him until the day comes that he arrives. What does this seem to show you? The odds are that it's going to be good, that he will be here, but it's going to take a long time. I'm going to wait for as long as it takes. You only say that I'm going to take however long it takes if you know it's going to take a while. Right? So it seems like we do believe that it's going to take a while. However, when was this Ani Mamin written? Who was the one who came up with the Ani Mamins? Good. Stacey, you have to be this. Morocco is wrong. Good. So the Rambam was the one who came up with Ani Mamins. The language of Ani Mamin Be'emuna Shlema, by the way, just parenthetically, was not written by the Rambam. The Rambam in his Shmona Prakim, his Parish Mishnayos, his explanation of the Mishnayos, is where he lies out all these 13 principles. But the language of Ani Mamin seems to be added later on by someone else who thought it sounded nice. Okay. So source number 6. Is a really important one. Why? Because it shows us how we... Sorry?
It shows where he tells me specifically in that 6 that he's going to arise from the house of David.
So good.
Focus more on
good. Very good, Carol. So not only does he tell us that he comes from the house of David, but he also tells us other qualifications that we'll know that will make this person, this individual, Mashiach. So take a look again, source number 6. Now, if a king should arise from the house of David, who is versed in Torah and engages in commandments, as did David his forefather, in accordance with both the written and the oral Torahs, and he enjoins all of Israel to follow in its ways and encourages them to repair its breaches, and he fights the wars of God, right? So why are these qualifications important? Who did not do these things? Jesus didn't do these things, right? Jesus was not a Mr. Talmud Chacham who made people follow the Torah, fighting the wars of God, right? That's another important one. Then he may be presumed to be the Messiah. So if he does these things, then you have the check off the first box. If he succeeds in his efforts and defeats the enemies around and builds the sanctuary in his proper place and gathers the dispersed of Israel, he is definitely the Mashiach. So the first qualification to know that this guy is maybe Mashiach is what? Has come from the house of David.
Right. He has to be well
He has to know Torah and teach Torah.
Torah.
And?
He has to be also a warrior.
Good, he has to fight war. So who did that? Bar Kokhba, right? That's why it was so believed that it could be that he could be the Mashiach.
Right.
Who did not do that? Jesus. Shabtai Tzvi, who knows what he was. And Shabtai Tzvi was like this great, You have to really understand Shabtai Tzvi. He was like literally a lunatic.
He
was really, really crazy. And the craziest thing is that people were following him. And it also shows you the desperation that people had to find that savior. Right. But he was really, based, again, I'm not a Shabtai Tzvi expert, but based on a little bit of studying and understanding who he was like really cuckoo for Cocoa Puffs and like really not all there. So even to put him in this category of saying, did he meet the qualifications? It's ridiculous. He did not meet the qualifications. Yes.
And when people are searching for things,
yes,
then they find someone to look to.
Yes.
Look at Reverend Moon years ago.
Right.
Yeah.
You look at all these cults.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
It's no joke.
People want something. People want to feel connected to something.
Exactly.
And
so they weren't exactly. It's a fervent kind of thing.
The hardest.
These people. And
the hardest part of.
Very open and fertile kind of a.
Yeah.
You know, atmosphere for people to latch onto
them. The hardest part about Judaism is that in Judaism we don't believe in a symbol or a figure that they are God, right? One of the biggest issues with the Chet Egel, with the sin of the golden calf, was the fact that the Jewish people thought that, according to some, that this golden calf was going to be their intermediary between them and God. In Judaism, we like to believe that we have a direct sort of a connection with God, that we can just speak to him one-on-one directly. So that also, as beautiful and as amazing as that is, that also creates this unhealthy world in which, Sima, I wasn't sure where I was going, so I really.
Well, right, so we have to follow this. This is my Jacob.
So the fact that you have other religions that have come up that have other symbols out there, for example, the fact that you have Christianity, that you have Jesus on the cross over there, that means you know who your God is. You're looking at your God. The hardest part about Judaism is
to make
everybody better. Oh God. Okay. So Debbie will give a share on Catholicism one time, and she'll explain the differences. But whatever, they have a symbol, right? They have something. In Judaism, we have the Jewish star, but the Jewish star has only been around for a couple hundred years. We have so little, but people are so desperately always searching for something to cling to say that it's Jewish. It's unbelievable, by the way, the fact that the Jewish star is such a relatively new Jewish symbol, but all Jews, not all Jews, a lot of Jews who have nothing to do with Judaism will love to wear a Jewish necklace with a Jewish star because I'm Jewish. I want to show that I'm Jewish. But right, yeah, exactly. But what is that? You should better to wear a Torah scroll on, it's fascinating that people want that so desperately. But again, that's not what Judaism has to offer, fortunately and unfortunately. Okay, so let's keep reading in the Rambam. But if he does not succeed in these matters, or take note of this word, or is killed, we will not know that he was not we will know that he was not the one Torah has promised. He is merely to be considered like all the other exemplary and qualified kings of the house of David who have died. Right? You could have great tzaddikim who do a lot of good things, but if they die, they die. God set him up only to try the masses, as it says, and some of the wise will stumble to refine among them and to purify and to make white even to the time of the end. For it is yet for the time appointed. Now, based on what we just read, again, I don't want to spend too much time on this because it's not it's murky territory. But talking about, again, Lubavitcher Rebbe, can you see why someone could interpret this to say that the Rebbe would still be Mashiach? This last English paragraph that we just read. So does it say he dies?
Yeah, he was killed.
Okay, good. So, fantastic line. So, someone might say that, again, the Rambam was very careful in all the words that he used. He was very careful with every single sentence that he wrote. And the fact that he wrote that Mashiach, that if the person is Neharag, if they are killed, then they're not Mashiach. But you might take this and imply to say, what if they die of natural causes? It could be, again, we don't believe in that. That's also cuckoo. But still, people could make such an argument. It's specifically important, again, with Chabad theology, because Chabad, they're very into learning the Rambam.
Like, since he passed away as the Mashiach, I don't really hear that as much.
Yeah. Okay, so we'll continue now. So again, source number 6 was the Rambam, in which we just went. Yeah, so source number 6 was the Rambam, where he said that these are the qualifications that will know that someone is Mashiach. Okay, let's take a look at source number 6.
Do we really believe, though, that Mashiach will never die? I mean, how?
No, again, the Rambam never said that he never dies. Okay, so first of all, it could be A, that he never will die, but
right.
That also goes into a larger theological question of understanding how Tachias HaMesim will work, right? If I'll just lay it out for you, but again, this is way complicated and way beyond the scope of the Shir, but if Mashiach is going to be responsible for bringing back the dead, right, in Tachias HaMesim, Well, how does Tchias HaMesim work? Do you die again? So it's a little bit unclear. Do you live on forever? If you live on forever, then maybe it's not so crazy the Mashiach to live forever. Right? So again, way beyond the scope of this year, but yeah, that's... Okay, source number 7, let's just take a look real quickly. I don't think I have a translation for you, but I'll read it and translate. He says, the Rambam, this is probably the most important part of the entire shir, says that as many details as I can give you about Mashiach and about the end of days and all that stuff, no one actually understands any of it. Shadvaram stumin hines lahanavim, that even the prophets were clueless as to understanding what the end of days would look like. Gama chachamim in lahem kabbalah b'dvaram elu. Our rabbis don't have any tradition on this. Elafi hechreya hapsukim. The only way people have been able to decipher anything has been through the verses. Some of the psukim are explained a little bit, and you can maybe draw some things out. Elafichach. If you look in particular at the end of Masech HaSanhedrin, in which a lot of these end of days discussions were found, there are just it's an exponential amount of arguments as to what the end of days will look like, when the end of days will come, when Mashiach will come. What's one year? Is there a year in particular that people remember that people say Mashiach has to come by?
Yeah, soon.
Yeah, when? So people say the Mashiach has to come by the year 6000. Okay, we'll see that Gemara in just... Have people heard that? No, maybe? No? Hebrew year 6000. Yeah. Mashiach is not going to use the Gregorian calendar. He's not into that. Well, this year is 5780, so 220 years. Yeah, we could do that. Okay, so let's take a look at the truth is, truth be told, if you look at the context of the world nowadays and how rapidly things are escalating and changing and going crazy, in another 200 years, is it so crazy and so hard to believe? Not for me to say. Okay, take a look at source number 8. It's very, very small, especially for those of us who are fasting and woozy, so I can blow it up at another point for you guys if you want to see it. But the only reason why I brought this list is just to get a sense of the predictions that have been out there. I cannot tell you the countless number of rabbis, great commentators throughout the centuries, who have taken a crack at saying when Mashiach is going to come. And this list goes through all of those times. So if you look, so all the way on the left, that's the people. The middle column is when they lived. The right column is the day that they predicted. If you could just skim very quickly, what does it seem to be? What's interesting about the dates that these rabbis chose? Okay, maybe. Say again?
Both during their lifetime?
Okay, good, exactly. The predictions that were made, usually people say that if Mashiach is going to come, he's clearly coming in my lifetime because things are so terrible. Right? So it's just important to be aware of the fact that the recurring theme throughout all Jewish history is that things have always been terrible for the most part, and because of that, people have always wanted to make predictions that the end of days is coming. Again, that seems to be...
1931.
Yeah.
1868 is the last date that you have.
Yeah.
So
again, the point of this is really just to show and to highlight the fact that we just have no idea. There have been really great rabbis who have made really strong assertions that this must be the year, and it's just turned out not to be true. Okay, let's take a look at source number 9 real quick, and then we'll wrap up pretty soon. So source number 9 is the Gemara in Sanhedrin, the one that we just mentioned a second ago, and that is as follows. The school of Eliyahu taught 6,000 years is the duration of the world. 2,000 of the 6,000 years are characterized by chaos. 2,000 years are characterized by Torah, from the era of the patriarchs until the end of the Mishnaic period. And 2,000 years are the period of the coming of the Messiah. So in other words, if the world is going to live for 6,000 years, that means that we are right now in that last 2,000 year period, and it must mean that Mashiach is going to come in this last time period. Now, it's not so clean cut. If Mashiach does not come... All right, maybe it is, maybe it isn't. If Mashiach does not come in the next 220 years, I wouldn't, you know, throw out our Jewish stuff. I still believe in God. I still believe in Mashiach. But it seems like that is the year that people do like to point to. Okay, let's skip source number 10. Source number 10 does speak a little bit about the time period that we're in right now. So we're not going to do it inside, but source number 10 just discusses, right? So we basically just took a few opportunities to say that every major prediction that has ever come to be of that this must be the time the Mashiach is coming, people have constantly been proved wrong. So it makes us feel a little bit bad that those of us who are like, you know, religious Zionists and believe, oh, this is the Etchalta de Gula, this is the time that the Gula is going to come, we feel like idiots in, you know, understanding the historical context. So there are people who do believe that, no, nonetheless, even though it has been different, even though people have been making predictions forever, nonetheless, this time is different. What's the biggest proof that this time is different? We have Israel now, right? So that would be a pretty big difference. It's major. It's, yeah, not to be played lightly. It's a major, major difference. Okay. What's that? They're turning around a little bit. They like Israel too now. Okay, maybe not the Turiya Karta, they don't like it so much, but everyone else. Okay. The question that I wanted to end on is that where does this all leave us, right? So we spoke a little bit about the crazy history about the false messiahs that have existed in world history. We spoke a little bit about what defines Mashiach, how we will know who he is. We spoke about the year that is going to come, and essentially we said we don't know, but we think there's a good chance that he might come by the year 6000, but again, we really have no way of knowing. So where does that leave us right now? And I wanted to end this year in a similar way that we just ended Kinos just a little while ago, and that is by source number 11. Source number 11 is a quote from the Truma Sedeshin. The Truma Sedeshin is Rav Yisrael Isserlin, and he was very fascinating because he, right, usually rabbis like to answer questions, so someone would send in a question, and he would write an answer. The Truma Sedeshin is so fascinating because not only did he answer questions, but he also wrote the questions. So he wrote the questions that he answered. Right? That's a different way of doing things. I'll just read the first few lines. Again, I apologize, there's no translation, but we'll read it slowly and translate it. He says as follows, he gives the following question. Ishis Eliyahu Hanavi. All right, so what do we know about Eliyahu Hanavi? How did Eliyahu Hanavi die? Good. Trick question. He never died. He went up alive in the chariot of heaven. So let me ask you guys a question. Can the wife of Eliyahu remarry?
No. Not really.
Why not? But he's no longer of this world. He's an angel. He's something else. Oh, maybe he's coming back. Maybe at the Pesach later that year. Okay. Okay, good. So let's see what the Truma Sedeshin has to say. Eishes Eliyahu Hanavi Zal. Oh, Eishes Rabbi Yishuv ben Levi. There's another Talmudic figure, Rabbi Yishuv ben Levi, who he said he also went up to heaven and never died. Im Yechulam Linasei Leish Acher. Can their wives marry other people? Nafkamina ledoros, and now the Truma Sedeshin says, it's a very interesting question, I guess. We can like argue about it in the Beis Medrash, but who cares? Like, what does it have to do with right now? So he says, no, it is relevant. Why? Gamkin im yiske echad kimohim. It could be that there could be someone else that rises in the world that is just like Eliyahu Hanavi. It's a powerful idea. He's saying that it could be that even though Eliyahu Hanavi was a great man and he is going to be the harbinger. He's going to be the harbinger of Mashiach, right? We know that right before Mashiach comes, that's when Eliyahu is going to come and he's going to sort of guide us a little bit. So the Truma Sedeshin says, who's going to be the next Eliyahu Hanavi? Anyone could be the next Eliyahu Hanavi. Anyone could be like him. And therefore, says the Truma Sedeshin, we have to ask this question. Let's say there's another Eliyahu Hanavi that comes around and he goes up to heaven. What happens to his wife? So I'll tell you the answer to the question and then we'll finish up. The Truma Sedeshin says a crazy idea. He says the reason is the wife could remarry. Why? Because we have situations of either the husband will give the wife a get or the husband will die. But let's say the husband turns into an angel. No such concept. We say if the husband is lost at sea, then that's an aguna. But a husband who turns into an angel, says the Truma Sedeshin, is allowed to remarry. That's what he says. Other people say it's ridiculous, but that's what he says. Again, I don't think that there are many people that are really concerned that this will happen. But nonetheless, the Truma Sedeshin was concerned that this was going to happen. And the ultimate message of this all... The ultimate message of this all, I think, is to realize, and again, the same way we concluded Kinos, is that every single person has within them the ability to bring Mashiach, to bring the redemption in some way, shape, or form. Every single person has a little bit of an Eliyahu Hanavi inside of them to help bring upon the redemption. So as we think about when is Mashiach going to come, what year, what date, I think the takeaway is to not focus on the actual date, but to focus on what we can do to bring Mashiach.